Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use. Hello, ladies. Hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I'm Jack Fowler, the host, the star and namesake. Victor Davis Hanson is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. He'll be teaching there in a couple of weeks. And by the way, I want to thank everyone who sent in questions, because Victor and I are going to record a couple of podcasts to cover the time period when he's at Hillsdale. We've got about 100 questions sent in. Thank you very much, all who did such. Victor also has a great website called victorhanson.com. You can find everything he writes there, and some stuff is exclusive. And we'll get to that in a little bit, tell you how to get on and read all that wonderful material. Victor, we got a lot to talk about today. By the way, I forget if I said the date yet. I'm talking before I'm thinking, which is my usual. It's Sunday, August 21st, and this particular podcast will be broadcast on Tuesday, August 23rd. The first thing we're going to discuss, Victor, is crime, the sucker punch in the Bronx, madness at the 7-Eleven in Los Angeles, and more. And we'll do that right after these important messages.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, we're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, I think most of the nation knows the story now about this sucker punch in the Bronx. Boy Van Phu, a long time, 30 plus year pervert criminal, I think was first arrested in 1994 for raping a woman, teenage woman in the Bronx, sent to prison. But he's the guy that 30 years later, he's been arrested numerous times over his life, just for no reason at all, stepped out of a place he was working at, saw this man on the street talking to others, came up behind him, punched him behind the head. Guy's still in a coma in a hospital. He was arrested, was let out by the Bronx DA for misdemeanor charges. And then the governor of New York, who had pressed for the legislation and now law that allows this kind of insanity to happen,
she immediately arose to the occasion and ordered the DA's office to rearrest him. And this character has been rearrested. But the fact, Victor, that these kind of crimes are happening, I have to say in my own life, you know, for myself, you tell by my accent, as I've said before, I'm from the Bronx. My nephew and godson is a cop in that precinct where this crime happened. My family grew up a block away from this. So there's some kind of emotional, geographical ties to the scene, but this is terrible. It's not just something that's happening in the Bronx, New York. Again, I'm sure many of our listeners saw these videos of this pillaging of a 7-Eleven store in Los Angeles. We've seen, this is of course nothing compared to the kind of riots that were destroying American cities 2 years ago. Victor, it's madness, and it is a society that whose leaders, whose elected leaders, are dubious about the law and protection of the citizenry. My ramble is over, Victor. Your thoughts?
No, we have all of our own nightmarish videos that are impressed on our brains. Mine is the poor Asian woman. You remember her that was kicked and by four teenagers, and then she tries to get up and get to a door and open the door and close it behind her, and not satisfied with that, then they go after her and try to kick her and kill her.
Right.
Or this the Ugandan, was he from Uganda or Ghana, maybe, the cab driver?
The cabbie was killed in New York City.
And he was running after the people who didn't pay their fare. I think there was two girls.
Three girls and two guys, who of course was a criminal. The kid, you know, had been arrested 10 times already.
And he tries to fight them, and then he's knocked down. And so the thing should be over. And then they come over there and, not happy with that, hit him again and kill him. So the question I have when I see all of these is, what is the attitude about all the three parties involved? Let's start out with the victim. The victim knows that, unfortunately, as a cab driver, the Asian woman, and I know everybody listening, that if you are violently attacked in America, nothing's going to happen necessarily to your assailant. And there might, what will get you in the news is fighting back. And if you shoot somebody, you may be under suspicion or you may be charged. So my point is that we feel, we, the nation of victims, that our life isn't worth anything. So what I feel is that if I were to get in my car today and go into one of the worst places, which is about 2 miles away from here, and just, I don't know, walk along there, and if I was shot and killed, no one would care. And the assailant would probably not be fully prosecuted. That's what I believe. And I think they do. So the question is, how long will a civilization allow that? And we don't want vigilantism. And everybody talks about being armed and caring, but the number in all of these cases that you see, and I can rattle off 10 or 15 the last 3 weeks, none of the victims had a gun. That one that was particularly strange, Jack, is the robbery of those people. Was that in the Queens as well, where they were just sitting there and these two robbers came up as people were dining, I think, and they just got off a motorcycle?
Right.
Yeah.
It may have been Queens, may have been Manhattan, but yeah, just brazen is the word.
And they knew probably two things, that the attackers had prior records, they were out. What I guess I'm saying is that, so the victim, it's just a cauldron. And at some point, and because the majority, not all, but I think the majority tend to be inner city victims. So when you were talking about that African-American guy that hit that guy, and he put on special gloves to hit him, that guy was a Hispanic guy that was knocked out.
Right.
So and the man that was killed was an African, not an African-American, but now maybe he is African-American. He's a citizen. The man from Ghana, I think he is.
I don't think they would want to be considered that.
Yeah. But my point is that it's not a racial thing as far as the victims are concerned. And they're getting angry. And I don't know how that's, manifests itself. Maybe in San Francisco, it was a recall, Boudin and Gascon, where suddenly California believes in voter integrity and wipes out 25% of the signatures to recall Gascon. But there'll be a third and a fourth and fifth time until the miscreant is taken out of office. So that's the first thing. The victims, this can't go on because civilization won't last. And when people look at this, Jack, from other countries, they don't want to hear any more lectures on the United States on race or woke or getting along, or we're a model. We're not a model to anybody. I can go to place, most cities in the world, maybe not Mexico City, or maybe not, I don't know, Nairobi, but most cities are safer than the Bronx and the Queens and Queen and San Francisco. So we've lost all moral authority on this issue of protecting the lives of the innocent. So then we go to the society at large. Who did this? Who allowed these people to go out? And that's, where does it start? It starts in the university with critical legal theory, critical race theory, critical this theory, critical that theory. And they all have one thing in common, that laws don't reflect natural nature of man, but they're constructs. So as I said earlier, it's against the law to steal a Snickers bar because white men don't steal Snicker bars, so to speak. But it's against the law because thousands of years of civilization say, if you go into a store and take something that's not yours and you're not punished, you will take and take and other people will take and there will be no store to help other people find goods. So they're unwinding civilization and they're all doing it from perches where they feel they're not subject to the consequences of their own ideology. And so they created this system, very wealthy, and I'll be frank about it, very wealthy white people living on the two coast and having careers or associations with academics and the media. They did it. And they feel, I guess, the catalyst for all this was their guilt. They feel that criminals were treated terribly by society, and society has to give them a number of chances. And the more chances they give the criminal, the more they'll finally wake up and say, you know, all of that magnanimity that society shows me, I want to reciprocate in kind and be nice to people, yeah, rather than these suckers let me out again to prey on the weak. So I'm really going to prey on the weak next time.
Right.
So they have a different view that human nature is malleable and it can be improved by greater education, nutrition, brainwave, video. I don't know what they think.
Well, I think you're being kind, Victor, because I think there is a
there is that one
racial
thing.
Payback is a
well, I'm going to get to that in next. Okay. So the third group are the assailants, and while we were talking, it took one nanosecond because I hadn't, you know, tried to prep because I didn't know what we were going to talk about. But the DOJ's Office of Justice Programs has released the latest statistics, and it's 2 years old, Jack. So crime has gone up. We know that in 2021 and probably in 2022. And of all offenses, violent offenses, they list 7,600,000. Okay. And then they break it down by, here's murders. There were 12,400 murders in the United States. 5,600 of them were committed by what they called whites. That's about 67%, 70% of the population. 6,380, that is 6,380, were committed by African Americans. And I think we could be fair in saying African American males, because I don't think a lot of African-American women are murdering very people. So just for the purposes of generalization, and we're not supposed to talk about this, but what I'm suggesting to our listeners is we have a problem that when you have 6,380 murders and the African-American male population is about 5.5% to 6%, and they are committing most, looks to me, about like 55% of all the murders in the United States are being committed in 2020 by about 6% of the population. So if you were to address that percentage of the population and you would say, well, human nature is flawed, so who's the majority population? Well, it's the white population, and they are 70% of the population. They committed half the murder, 56, 80. So we want the African-American population to commit about the same percentage versus their percentage in the population. So then that would be probably of 12,000, that would be about 1,200 or less. And that would mean there'd be 5,000 people alive right now if African-American males just committed murder at the rates of their representation in the general population. And those, because about 92% of their victims are other African-Americans, mostly males, that would be 5,000 African-American males would be alive. So
right.
We don't talk about that.
Right.
And why don't we talk about that? And we don't talk about that because the white liberal establishment feels that given the history of racism in the United States and the relatively recent, oh, let's just say 50 years of the civil rights movement and affirmative action, that we have not yet compensated duly for our grandparents' and great-grandparents' sins, and therefore we have to excuse violent acts. That would be one explanation. And they're not antithetical. Another would be that the African-American community's leadership, and Al Sharpton, a Louis Farrakhan, the Squad, some member, Presley, whatever, Ian Omar now, they feel that that inordinate proportion of African-American males that are preying on mostly other people of color, but also people of different races, that somehow that affect society in a way that people want redress. And the redress in this cycle is not more incarceration or indictments, apparently among our elite, but more programs. For Bill Clinton, it was midnight basketball. Remember that? And for others, it is more social. The $20 trillion of the Great Society poverty. And who are the beneficiaries of that? And I'll tell you what I mean more specifically if people say, well, Victor, you're being wishy-washy. Okay, we had the George Floyd matter, and then the whole country erupted with this idea that the police were just rampantly killing, even though the Washington Post showed us that of all the people being arrested, not represented in the general population, but being arrested, African-Americans were not killed unarmed by policemen any more than other root weeks. Okay. Nevertheless, we wanted to do something. What did we do about that? Well, for the inner city person who was the victim of this crime wave, or this, and also the targets as a member of a race that we wanted to have atonement for and reparatory, he got nothing. He got a defunded police. In other words, we feel so bad about George Floyd, we're going to take away the police and allow this 6% of the population who's committing 50 to 55% of the murders to prey on you, your next door neighbor. And then we said to the elite, the children of the high school principal, the children of the ophthalmologist, the children of the investment banker, if you're not white, you're going to get a greater share of college admissions and hiring. That's what we're going to do as pious white liberals. And that's what they did. And so in a weird, I'm not saying it's preordained, but if you look at the mechanism that's happening, and people far smarter than myself have pointed this out in voluminous literature, that the crime of the underclass predatory African-American male somehow gets transmogrified into a social reaction to it that says the causes that why people are murdering people must be social economic, and they must be us, right, the guilty American citizen. And to redress that, we want to help and give reparatory aid to people. And that can consist of, we're not going to use the SAT anymore. Right. We're not going to look at GPA. we're going to have a quota. Okay. And that's how it works. And that is one of the reasons why if an African-American unarmed suspect is shot by a police tomorrow, you will see a press conference of African-American leaders like Al Sharpton. But you won't see, and you saw, I think it was at that Philadelphia theme park. That's where everything jumped the shark, as far as I'm concerned, this year, Jack, is when that person, was it Rosalinda or something, that PBS stuffed animal character walked by, and you could see all the distractions, and a poor African-American little girl reached her hand out, and then the person in the costume passed by.
Right.
Well, I can remember being a youth in costumes. You have very little peripheral vision. But whatever it is, that was, and then all of these civil rights attorneys sued the costume person, right. I guess, in the park for $25 million.
Then also Legoland is now
Legoland, being sued, yes.
Similar.
So that tells it all. When that gets a $25 million lawsuit, and all of these people are being slaughtered and killed, and none of those people show up and say, we've got to do something. African-American young men inordinately are committing crimes at about five times their percentage. If you take males and not everybody, 6% are committing 50%, eight to nine times more than their percentage in the population. And the victims are mostly people. And we want to help a little girl who was inordinately or indifferently or accidentally, you know, neglected by a stuffed animal character. But this is life and death. And they're not going to do that. And then the question rises, why don't they do it? And the answer is, if you were to do that, people would say, so members of the African-American community are trying to address pathologies among a subset of the population, and that would suggest that there is culpability among that subset of the population.
Right.
It transcends what society did to them or what society can do for them. And that's where no one wants to go, because if you do that, it is like plugging a 110 plug into a 220 outlet.
Right.
It'll just melt the whole damn thing down.
Isn't that where we are?
They do not want to do that, because suddenly, all of a sudden, it would jolt the entire society. Mm-hmm. And a dean at Yale would say, you know what? If I let in 15% African-American students, and according to traditional criteria of scores and tests, maybe only 12% should have been admitted, that's not going to do anything for this problem. It has nothing to do with this problem. This is a different problem. And so then finally, what is the problem? Well, the problem is, I'm just taking a cue from Robert Woodson, Shelby Steele, Tom Sowell, people who know the problem far greater than I do, but I've read what they've written. It's number one, that whereas most other demographics, I think whites are 26%. That's a shocking number in itself of families without a father. The African-American community is over 70%, three times higher proportionally. Poverty is one thing, but poverty is caused often by a father not being around, the main breadwinner not being around. And then secondly, the popular culture doesn't glorify fathers being there. Look at NBA stars. How many of the NBA stars give lectures about either staying married to the people that staying married, or if they're not staying married, supporting all of their children and being, I don't mean financially, I mean being there. None of them do. And then when you look at the popular music, what do you hear? Do you hear obey the laws and respect the police? No. You hear Lamar James at the White House being Googled and giddied and gushed over by the Obamas as their favorite rapper. And then you listen to one of his Kill the Popo police, you know. So rap music, stock and trade, is not just misogyny and violence against women, but open talk about killing police. And then the N-word, using that word, that's nothing we're not supposed to talk about. But when you have an entire genre that refers to other people in deprecatory ways, it would be as if country western music right now, every single, you know, popular ballad said cracker, trash, tracker. And then when other people said, oh, wow, that, and then they would start to reflect that. And so no one says of that multi-billion dollar industry, don't use that word. Don't talk about violence toward the police. Don't refer to women as bitches and whores, because every time you do that, you dehumanize human life in all of its manifestations, whether it's gender or persons of authority or yourselves. Don't do that. And I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that anybody is going, and it can't come from the white community. It can't come from the white elite community, because we know the white academic media, political, wealthy, elite white community has caused the problem or helped cause it. So the result is that, how's it all filtered down in conclusion? Don't go to certain places. Professor, you know, I got in big trouble with Todd Nahisi Coates. Remember him?
I do.
Yes. Letters or advice. And he gave this thing about what your son should be doing, right? Avoid this place. And he had good grounds. I have no problem with that. There was institutional racism. I get that. But my problem with that article, it became part of the book, was, do you really believe statistically that the police who shot about 25 African-American unarmed people is the problem right now, as far as the thousands of African-Americans who are killed? And if you do believe that and you want to warn your son about the police, would you also warn your son where it's far more, 90% more likely to be shot? And then I said to myself, if you're going to stereotype people like that, then do other people give lectures? And I wrote it. It was for National Review. I said, and I said, you know, my father, we were from a rural family. There were one or two African-American families in our immediate neighborhood. We were good friends of them. I've written about one family who was a master Ford mechanic. I went to school with all his children. They're his wife's children. They were wonderful people, some of my best friends, so to speak, in stereotype fashion. However, my father said to me, now you're going up to the Bay Area to school, and you better be careful if you walk over there to East Palo Alto. And you better be careful if you go to Oakland. And then no sooner had he written that, my mother, he took her up to a conference. He got out of the car. Four African-American men confronted him with my mother. And he said, if I give you each, I think it was $5 at the long time, would you just leave my wife and I alone? He was a big guy. He was perfectly willing to confront them. And they took the money, which was a polite robbery. And then he left. And then when he came back, he said, did you remember what I said? Well, I didn't remember, because I rented an apartment in East Palo Alto when I was a graduate student. And I can tell you that one of the first things I remember is a hand coming through the door at night. My roommate and I taking a bat and trying to fend her off. Right. And then the next day, going to the local market and seeing somebody with his hand wrapped up in a bandage.
Justice.
Threw a bottle of beer, full bottle of ice cold beer, right at my head.
Oh.
And then I can remember the next week riding my bicycle down University Avenue, starting in East Palo Alto, and having a group of people drive by in a pickup, jump off and try to take my bicycle with me on it. And I was like some kind of jellyfish or octopus. I was holding it. I was getting hit and trying to run off with it. And then 2 years later, my wife and I, she worked at a mental hospital, and seeing a mental patient and on the street. And she said to me, they're making fun of him. And there was an inner city gang that was pushing him. And then me intervening, there happened to be another person with me, a male, three of us. And we intervened and were able to stop their attack on a mental patient. But my point is, that if you're going to stereotype people and say that, then there is also a lecture for people. And this is where we get into this endless cycle of generalization. But a lot of people say, I'm not going to the Queens. I'm not doing this. And the people who are saying that, Jack, are people that are not living in Fresno County. They're living in Atherton. They're living in Menlo Park. They're living in Woodside. And they say to themselves, I will not go down into East Palo Alto at a certain time. I will not go into the Queen. If I'm on the Upper West Side, I will not go into Queens or other places like that at certain times or at all. And maybe even not in my own neighborhood now. Right. And when that happens, you'll get action. But we're getting close to that.
Yeah, my aforementioned nephew, godson, the cop, says that one of the safest areas in the Bronx was called Little Italy. And when New York had the blackout and riots in 76, that was a safe neighborhood. Nobody went there.
Is it still safe there?
No, because he says now, do not go there. Don't go there to get your mozzarella or whatever. Just, you know, don't go there.
Well, see, when they say don't go there and don't do that. So what is I'm curious, what does an Upper West Side or Park Avenue New Yorker mean when he says, don't go above 128th Street or something after 6 o'clock? What do they mean by that?
You know, it means that if you go up there, you're probably going to get mugged. That's what they're saying.
And they're saying
that taking your life into your hands, not safe. Yeah.
And that would be a wealthy white person, a wealthy Asian person, and a wealthy African-American person.
Or it might be a guy from the outer boroughs who would say, you know, the same thing. Like,
see, they don't say that, though, but that's what they're saying.
Right.
And everybody knows it. But then I'm going to get a lot of calls about this, you know, probably from Stanford people about talking about in the way that is reality. And so what I'm trying to say is it's all based on the theory of exemption. So the Upper West Side person or the wealthy person in Nob Hill who dreams up and supports this lax criminal policy or feels terrible, but they themselves have internalized a whole code of conduct to protect themselves.
Right.
They don't want to be around, or I'm going to quote Jesse Jackson, they feel relieved when the person walking behind them is not an African-American male.
Right.
And that's terrible, because if you look at, I mean, still statistically, the number of African-American males who are attacking people is a small portion of the African-American community. But of the people who attack people, it's 55%.
Right.
And so people have made the necessary adjustments. And we're never going to get to a solution unless people talk about this. And nobody,
Victor,
nobody will touch it. Nobody. We keep saying, oh, crime has spiked. Well, this is this. And then you say, and when you look at the DOJ statistics to the degree they're candid, and you look at Asians, Latinos, and they are listing it by race, probably because they want to look at the victims more than the assailants. But they're listing it. And then you draw the necessary conclusion. Oh, my God. A small percentage, we wouldn't eliminate crime, but if we just got each group represent, you know, like Asians are underrepresented. And then when we look at hate crime, it's double.
Can I just interject about this particular case with the sucker puncher, right?
Yes.
So I went on the sex. He was first arrested, as I said before, 30 years ago for raping a woman in the Bronx and got 6 years to life. And got out and committed many other crimes. But he's on the sex offender registry, so I went to look at it. Now, you said that this black guy, because you look at his pictures and you think that he looks like a black guy.
He is. Yes.
Right. His name is Van Phu Boy. It doesn't say where he was born, but it implies with his, if you saw that name and you see a picture, you'd think this guy's from Vietnam. Now, maybe he was born in Vietnam. Maybe he's the son of a black American soldier over there. There's nothing on this information page about where he was born, but they call his race Asian and his ethnicity. This is so freaking weird. Not Hispanic. That's his ethnicity on the official New York.
They do.
So it's, I mean, Jack, not to say the reality. This is a black man.
I'm a recipient because I'm associated as an emeritus professor and an active senior fellow at two universities. So I get a mandatory Clery Act warning Clariac, remember, was a young girl that was murdered. And then her parents sued because the university didn't tell her exactly the crime situation in the general vicinity of that campus. Right. In reaction to that, every university is mandated by law periodically to report to, I guess it's Department of Education or Justice or both, the crime rate in that general and break it down in that general area. And when there is a crime committed, they are to notify the university community the nature of the crime and the full description of the suspect. And I can tell you that after the George Floyd death, the exactness or the detail of those descriptions vanished. So now it'll say suspect's description unknown or male suspect, but they will not, and to the same degree they did before, list the race, or they will have a rejoinder at the bottom that says, this is basically, I don't want to be quoted, but the bottom will say, we are doing this because of the Clery Act, meaning we don't want to give you any description, but we have to because it's a law. And my point is, when I read these things, when it says a woman on one of the campuses I'm associated was raped, and another one, you know, there's catalytic converters stolen, things like that. But when they don't do that, and they have a description, or they know the description, or they think they do, they're basically saying, on the one hand, if we were to give you a description, even though we're required to by law, we would risk inflaming this particular community who would get angry and start to, you know, maybe fire some of us, versus the general community. You can take one for the team. We don't really care about you. We're not going to give you the description of this particular assailant, even though he may be empowered by that silence on our part. And that's a pretty heavy charge to make, but I've noticed it.
Right.
I notice it everywhere. I notice it in the media. I notice it on television, that people, if you have an assailant and that assailant is a white male, then you're going to put that description. I'm glad they do, by the way. I want both for purposes of shame and purposes of personal protection. But if the person is a person of a protected minority class, there's a lot much greater odds that that will not be.
Right.
I don't know. I'm trying to find out the liberal mind, because I just saw a statistic that about 55% of television commercials now have African Americans in them, which are 12% of the population. And is the theory that after George Floyd, the more people that are visible as successful in these commercials, and, you know, there's no statistical evidence, but it does seem that the African American is the wizened authority in the commercial. So somebody's doing something stupid, eating too much, and then it's sort of the reversal of the old racist stereotype where the white guy was, which is, you know, and you have kind of a step and fetch it white person now that we're in these commercials. And, you know, we have this horrific racism of our past, and then this subtle sort of racialism, not racism, but racialism, in the sense that if we overrepresent this demographic, that's doing our part for positive imagery. And then children growing up in that community will have positive imagery for a change, where African Americans are confident, full of authority, and can counsel less successful whites. And therefore, there will be less propensity to commit these violent crimes at 4 or 5 times the percent of the population. But it's a flawed premise, because you'd be much easier just having a national education campaign about the value of the nuclear family and the importance of a male and the importance not to provoke a person of authority like a policeman. Right. And the idea that you don't take a human life and don't carry an unlicensed gun, et cetera, et cetera. And we're not going to do that, because to do that would be to violate the progressive credo.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the poverty rates of Black married couples, families versus non-married. It's factors, multiple factors.
I never talk about that. I never understood this. I was an 18-year-old guy who had the misfortune of going to UC Santa Cruz because my parents, God bless them, thought that that was 170 miles away, the closest UC, University of California campus. It was brand new. My two brothers and I, we could all go there and save money by renting a place. There was no tuition at that time. Okay. So I get there and I'm there the first month. There were co-ed dorms where, you know, you had one part of the hallway and then women right next to you had the other part. And a woman walked down, I shouldn't say woman, a girl about 19. And she said, oh, my purse has been stolen. And there were all sorts of people coming into those dorms. I mean, you didn't judge people. It was pre-homeless, but there was homeless. There was everything in those dorms. I mean, every Petronian excess you can imagine. And this woman, I said, well, how much did you lose? She said, $20 was in my purse. That was a lot in 1971. I said, wow. And I said, well, did you call the police or did you see anybody? Let me know. I can see if I can help you. Oh, no, I have it. And they don't, or they wouldn't have taken it. I said, well, what if they had more than you and they still took it? I said, you think people that shouldn't eat ice cream don't eat ice cream? They eat more ice cream than people that could. And she said, well, I don't believe that. Well, then I said, well, why don't you go get another $40 and put it in your purse and put your purse outside the door? But my point was, that was my first experience with, and the more I talked to her, the more she was explaining the whole ideology of reparation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, that was basically the idea that my grandparents or my parents had been racist to the society and my generation is fighting racism. And then we're going to take a hit for the team and not indulge in that. And I don't know who took, but she felt that the person who took her money, there were a lot of people in the dorms that day, deserved the money because of society's injustices to him or his demographic.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, Victor, we should move on about, and I don't want to get the last word unless you want it, but I just sort of say the concentrated talk here about race and crime to me comes down to, we don't have, unless we have the equal application of the law that's race blind, we are entering, approaching the abyss of civilized destruction of our civilization. And that you brought up, you made a point earlier based on statistics. And the fact is, when there was, in New York City alone, rigorous law enforcement, the kind that Bloomberg, when he was mayor after Giuliani and Bloomberg, brought sanity back to New York. There is very calculable, given what the murder rate was before what they call the broken windows theory was first implemented. And there are scores of thousands, 60, 70, and as every year goes on, more people alive today who are disproportionately Black and Hispanic because of law enforcement. They would have been murdered minus this. And this is a good thing that they are alive today, that Black people are alive today because of justice. And how this has gotten lost on our society in general and the madness of the last few years is one of the more bewildering and troubling things. And to go back to those terrible days, and this can get much worse. I've said this before on this podcast. It has been much worse, and it's approaching there. This is not somewhere we want to go.
I think people should, I'll just finish the conversation. We were talking about people that don't want to contribute. When I was mentioning DOJ statistics, I think it's something like 3,000 law enforcement agencies, Jack. They don't send data in. It's like 15% because of what we're talking about. In other words, when they look at the data and they think, wow, this is inordinately race-based, we're not going to contribute to stereotypes, so we're not going to send the DOJ or the FBI or crime lab because to do it would be unfair. So they're willing to tell their own local communities that we're not going to participate in information that might be of your value to stay alive. And the thing about it was, if you look at the last decade, we're seeing that the percentage of victims who are Black, they've gone up 3 or 4%. and the assailants that are Black have gone up 3 or 4%. And the white assailant and the white victim has gone down by the same token. It's a big argument. I understand people are listening. You hear people say African-American population is 12, 12.5, 13.1, 13.8, 14.2. I heard all of them. But when you get up to, you know, 33% of all violent crime, and I think it's 55, I think I said 53, but it's more like 55% of all homicide victims. I'm talking about victims. That 33% of all crime victims and 55% of all people who are murdered are African American, and the statistics of the assailant is even higher, than when you say crime in America, at least violent crime, I'm not talking about stock theft and insurance fraud and all these other horrific crimes, and they are horrific, then we should be concentrating on the bang for the buck, how we can address this, rather than to suggest that even to talk about it is somehow racist. And so I don't have any solutions other than honesty. And that's
right.
That we should just tell the truth and then let people deal with the reality.
Right. Absolutely. Because people do deal with reality. They just don't talk about it.
Well, they do it about it. We should either do it as a society and officially,
right,
or keep outsourcing it to the individual and unofficially.
Right.
Because that's always dangerous when the society is incapable. It's the same thing with the border. If you don't want to talk about illegal immigration and the social dislocation, disequilibrium that it causes, and the greater propensity of all sorts of social pathologies when people, you know, come across the border illegally versus legally,
right,
then it's going to get worse and worse. It creates cynicism. And there was an article, you mentioned the Wall Street Journal, there was an article on, I think it was Holman Jenkins, who's a pretty sober and judicious guy, and he was talking about lies.
I saw him last night. Yeah, he is. Yeah,
lies, yeah. Lie. And he said, you know, the whole, all the world's going to end, climate change lie, mm-hmm, and all these other lies. And he was critical of Trump, but
right,
when you get the impression that this society is lying to you on basic fundamental issues, you know, basic fundamental issues. When Merrick Garland gets up there and says the FBI is a group of professionals and I'm going to, and this raid had nothing to do with politics, and you know he's lying, or you know people will not mention these lies of omission, then it creates, you know, I wrote an article a long time ago called Empire of Lies. And I just got up one day and I said, you know, these people just lie continuously to you. And I was that way in academia. I just felt that every dean that I talked to, every provost I talked to, it was just all lies. It didn't reflect reality. And then I was supposed to go in there and lie too. You know what I mean? When I looked at it, I was the head of a tenure committee and I was supposed to say, well, this, but you just had to lie. Well, Victor, I couldn't do it anymore.
Well, we've been, as a society, as you just alluded to, we've been drowning in lies, including from the CDC. And we've gone pretty long so far in this show, but let's try and have just one more subject. Yep. And we'll talk about the CEC's weirdo quasi denial, not denial, public statement that they maybe somehow mishandled the pandemic, or at least the messaging of it. And we will do that right after these important messages.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this. Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I am Jack Fowler. If you're interested in the little thing I do, that's called Civil Thoughts. That's a weekly email newsletter I write for the Center for Civil Society at American Philanthropic. I do more than that, but that's one of the things I do. It's a free weekly newsletter, 12, 13, 14 recommended readings. No risk. Not your name's not being put on any list. Sign up for it at civilthoughts.com. A few Victor links and things. I've failed to mention for the longest time that if you're on Facebook, two things you should check out. One is a non-affiliated, non-related group called the Victor Davis Hanson Fan Club, and they are fans of Victor Davis Hanson, and tons of links in there about things Victor does. So why don't you check that out, the Victor Davis Hanson Fan Club. But also on Facebook, there's VDH's Morning Cup. And you should check that out and sign up for the whatever you can sign up for there. So that's on Facebook. You follow Victor also on Twitter. He's at VD Hanson. One last business note, Victor, because I mentioned on one of the last episodes, I had mentioned our friend David Bonson's new project. It's called the Bonson Economics Course. And I got a ton of emails from people like, what was that thing you said? And where, cause you know, how does, with a Bronx accent, what the hell's Bonson? You know, it could be B-O-N-S-O-N, right? What's Bonson? So I just want to recommend folks, it's Bonson, B-A-H-N-S-E-N. That's how you spell Bonson. Bonson Economics Course. You'll find it at bonson.com. Check it out. And your website, victorhanson.com. There is a significant amount of exclusive content there. Here's a piece we'll talk about on our next podcast. How and why do Democrats become revolutionaries? Aren't you interested in Victor's analysis there, folks? Guess what? Unless you're a subscriber, you can't read it. So do subscribe. It's $5 for a month. Try it. Try it for just $5. See what you see. You're going to like what you see. It's a full year at $50. So that's victorhanson.com. Victor, okay, my friend, backing a little into your previous discussion, Mountain View, California, right, is not too far, I think, from where you bash somebody's arm sticking through a window or back in the when you were in college. There's a story out, and we'll really talk about the CDC, but a four-year-old girl or boy, I forget, actually, was taken away from school. School started already in Mountain View, which is right next to Palo Alto, and because the kid didn't want to wear a mask. And I was kind of shocked. Like, are you kidding me? Are they still freaking wearing masks in some schools? This is insane. Even here in Milford, Connecticut, they dropped this crap. But it's still going on, and it's still insane. And why? Why is this even happening? Where did all this mask wisdom come from? Well, it came from the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, which how it got the authority to make these pronouncements that totally overturned Americans' lives and destroyed Americans' lives and got Americans lost their jobs because their company, genuflected to the CDC's made up recommendations at the time, and people didn't follow, didn't get the shots, lost their job, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's just so much disaster has come from this one little, maybe it's not little, it was one powerful federal agency, which this week kind of admitted, Victor, right? Maybe we didn't message this right. I don't sense any, like, we effed up. But if they effed up, they effed up because they just didn't convey the wisdom, their wisdom all that correctly. So, Victor, enough of my babbling here. Your thoughts about...
Well, it's a question of treating people like adults. So one reason people are confused about masks is they have been brought up that when you're in a group of people and you sneeze, you cover your face or your mouth. You put your hand over, or when you blow your nose, you get out a hanky, right? Okay. And they know when they go to a restaurant and there's a salad bar. What do they call those salad, you know, those plexiglass things that get
sneeze
over?
Sneeze guards.
Yes. And that's a sneeze guard. They understand that. So when this deadly epidemic came out, and for 2% of the population or 1%, it is deadly, that was a natural thing. So people were conducive to that. But when they went the next step and said, mask, i.e. generic mask, you can make a mask, you can buy a cheap knockoff mask, you can do this. I bought a mask, you know, I didn't have a mask wear, and I had to buy it at a place, and literally it fell apart the moment I put it on. And I've seen people on, I've seen filthy, dirty cloth mask on planes. Okay. They don't do any of that. They just say mask or no mask. So people started to get cynical. And then when you had Anthony Fauci saying, we're not going to have mask. He said that the initial of the outbreak, it doesn't have any utility or scientific support. And then, well, one mask. And then he was later asked for two. Well, why not? And then when you see Joe Biden take a mask off right after he's had COVID and cough. So they didn't give us any information. What if they just said this, Jack? I am Anthony Fauci in April of 2020. And I'm just doing this ad hoc, so bear with me, listeners. I am Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. The question has come up, should we all wear masks in public? It's a difficult question because the science is ambiguous. We brought up with the idea that a mask would stop particles from emanating that had infectious material. Okay, but all masks are not equal. And I know that we cannot get all N95 masks to everybody, but an N95 mask has some utility. So if you have one or you have access to one, please wear it in public when you go out in public. If you don't have one and you're ill, or you think that someone is ill, you're welcome to wear it if you like. It may or may not. We don't have the science protect you. What if he had just said that? I don't think we'd have any of this problem. And he could. And then when he had a press conference and people said, well, what's the data? And he said, well, Sweden is under an experiment right now, and they are not social distancing or masking, and other Scandinavian countries are like Denmark or Norway have a different idea. And we're going to watch very carefully various ingredients to this paradox. Number one, we're going to see what the per capita hospitalization rate, infections, case rate, death rate is. And then number two, we're going to look at the relative GDP, suicide, spousal abuse, any incidence and rise in cancer, cardiac problems, to see about the damage that a lockdown would do and a staying in place, et cetera. And then we're going to correlate in a cost-benefit analysis and then give recommendations to you. Recommendations, not mandate. Had they done that, we wouldn't be in this situation because people are intelligent. So I've been all during the epidemic, I flew places and I sat next to people who had, it was a mask mandate on a plane eventually. And I tell you, Jack, I could not believe what I saw. I mean, I saw handkerchiefs. I saw one guy, I don't know what they were, but they were dirty. They weren't doing anything. And then I saw people who would pull it down over their chin because they were allowed to when they were eating, and they'd have a straw for like 3 hours.
Right.
And so my point was that
the lingering sip. Yeah.
Yeah. There was no consistent policy. And then it was passed off as quote unquote the science. And anybody who objected in a very calm and rational manner, and I'm thinking of Jay Bhattacharya, a colleague at Stanford, and Scott Atlas, a good friend of mine, and they were caricature. They said, oh, they want us, they're super spreaders, or they believe in herd immunity, just letting everybody die and then we'll get immunity. No. From the very beginning, they were the anti-Faucis. They said, by all means, protect. Scott even said that workers that were in association or were assigned to take care of long-term patients in facilities should sort of stay there until the epidemic was over. In other words, they would go on Monday and stay in a trailer or overnight so they wouldn't come, and they could be locked down because their immune systems were so fragile. But for children who, at least in the initial strains, had so much greater immunity, he never said there's not a risk. Neither did Jay. They said, in a cost-benefit analysis, the damage that we are going to do to children by depriving them of school and social interaction and education versus the threats to their health by contracting the coronavirus, it's a no-brainer. Right. And Victor, the medicine is worse than the disease. That's what they said. And they were demonized. Their careers were almost destroyed.
So Scott and Jay and others, they're focusing on the science and they're demonized by the scientists who are really ideologues. They're Stanford colleagues.
They decided Scott, because Scott was on Fox and he worked for Trump and he was high profile. They wrote letters that he was almost culpable for death, and they signed them and they wanted him out. He's a tenured professor fellow. They wanted him out. They just tried to destroy him. They almost did. And now when we look back at the entire epidemic and we go back, and I did this, Jack, because I want to interview him next week. So I've been looking at things he said. I read his book, etc. And when I look back at it, 3 or 4 months, and he wrote a lot of op-eds before he was hired by Trump. So there's things there and things like The Hill. You can go back and look at it. And anyway, my point is, he said that there is natural immunity. When people were saying, it's not much at all, he said there's natural immunity. He didn't know how long it would last, but he explained why, that it wasn't just the spike protein, but it was the totality of the virus that the immune system reacted to. And he said that the vaccinations may end up like flu vaccinations. That is, that they would have to be given semi-annually for a rapidly mutating virus. And everything, it was all logical. It was always based on previous experience. It was the scientific method. And he said, by all means, get vaccinated. He got vaccinated. He got vaccinated. He told people that. He said, keep the schools open. If you have a proper N95 mask and you're in a group of people, then by all means wear it. But do not shut down the economy. Do not wear a mask in a car by yourself. Do not wear some ad hoc cloth thing that you manufacture just to look like you're any. And for that, the quote unquote science, the top scientist at Stanford University went after him. They went after Michael Levitt. They went after John Ioannidis. They went after Jay Bhattacharya. They went after Scott Atlas. And I said to a very high ranking administrator, we should be very proud at Stanford University. We had 4 of the greatest epidemiologists, health policy experts, and immunologists and biologists in the world that were giving us a sound advice. And we, the Stanford community, demonized and tried to destroy them. And so this mask, a 4-year-old, and I'm speaking as a grandfather, and I have 2 grandchildren that got COVID. One of them severely disabled and has a lot of respiratory sinus problems because of the structural problems of Smith-Magenis syndrome. And she got over it. And I'm speaking also as one who did wear a mask, who got the 2 Moderna shots, who followed all the mandates and got not only COVID, but long COVID, which I still have, and I'm wiped out. But I don't blame people sneezing on me, or I don't blame policy. That everybody has a different immune system, a different history with infectious diseases, a different exposure to viral load. And everybody as an adult can gauge the risk benefit. For me, If I had not gone out to 10 different occasions with 500 people and shaking hands for 8 or 9 hours a day with receptions and books, all that stuff, you would. But that's the same thing true for a much more important occupation, like a frontline doctor or frontline nurse. They could all avoid COVID if they just didn't get a big Bible load, but they didn't, because they had no choice. They wanted to do something. And so it became kind of a moral thing that if you got COVID, then you did something wrong, or you didn't follow. You know, I've had so many people say, well, did you get the two Moderna shots? Did you get the boosters? Did you mask? And as I said to one person, the head of Pfizer just got two. Right. He's got COVID. And Anthony Fauci got two shots, two boosters, Paxlovid, second dose, by the way, off the label, not CD approved, of getting another round of Paxlovid.
Wow.
So, you know, and I'm sure that it mitigated the symptoms and he's fine. And Joe Biden, you know, with wearing his mask or whatever he was doing with all of his boosters, I don't know if he got two or three, but he got it. And he apparently is no worse off than he was before he got it, or we don't know.
He's in a basement in Delaware, surrounded by an emerging $500,000 fence. So
I just don't understand why we should be fighting like this when the problem was in the Wuhan lab, when we had, as we talked with Stephen Quay,
right,
this was an engineered, most likely an engineered virus that had mutability, infectiousness, and morbidity that were a little bit different than other natural occurring viruses.
Right.
And due to the laxity, et cetera, of a Chinese military control lab, this came out and no one is talking about it. No one is saying, can't we at least go to the Chinese and have them fess up and tell us exactly the type of research, the genetic sequence, everything about this virus, so that we can work with it instead of lying about it that some stupid pangolin 100 miles away or a bat. It's never not one case. So anyway, I don't want to get off on that tangent, but yeah, I just don't understand how you go after.
Because never let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah, so well, that's part of it.
And unleash the virtue signaling. That's
what it is. I wrote an article called The Bloomberg Effect. That was 10 years ago when you had that record snowstorm in New York. And Mike Bloomberg, who's a good mayor, he just couldn't stop the snow from piling up on people's doorstep. They couldn't remove it fast enough. So he started talking about supersized drinks. And the dangers of Coca-Cola or something for people who were obese or had high sugar counts. So, and that's what we do in America. When we can't address the felony, we fixate on the misdemeanor. When you can't go after the inner city multi-felon who's killing people and you're going to let him out, then you'll go after the guy who has a rolling stop at his intersection. Mm-hmm. And if you can't get the high-tech investment guy who doesn't pay any taxes because he's got an array of lawyers who convince us it's only capital gains, not income, then you go after the guy with a plumbing business and get him for having, you know, a car that he took too much of a deduction on the engine rebuild or something.
Yeah. Which happens and will happen increasingly, as we know now. Hey, Victor, we've gone over, but we've got a few other things to do. So let me just thank you. It's really great, your wisdom today, just off the charts. Again, recommend to our listeners to visit victorhanson.com. Thanks to those who listen on, who are listening. As we're recording, by the way, today on Sunday, the 21st, and again, this particular podcast will be up on Tuesday, the 23rd. Where our ranking, Victor, is on the news related podcasts in America, number 9, number 8. So, hey, that means a lot of people are listening. We appreciate it. Those who listen on Apple Podcasts, or as we're told, some can still listen on the old iTunes, can leave ratings. Many do leave 5-star ratings. The vast majority do. So we're happy we're producing something that you like and you find useful and good. some people leave comments, and I just want to read two today, Victor. And one of them is going to be about me. So the first one's not about me, it's about you. Continuing my education with Mr. Hansen. I love this podcast. So many ideas to follow up on. So many paths to explore. Many thanks to Professor Hansen and his insight on what is occurring in our world. I am so glad I dumped traditional news years ago. What a waste of time. This is from great, great, great. That's who it signed off. So thanks for that. Now about myself serving, I just think this is, people complain, people criticize. You can't act like they don't. So here's one. It's from Ed McGill. And it's titled, Don't Miss a Single VDH Podcast. So it starts off with a compliment. I've read many of Dr. Hansen's books, and I never miss his podcast. I would like to take issue with Jack Fowler's disdainful dismissal of vegetarianism and vegan diets. I've been a vegetarian for more than 45 years. In recent years, I've eaten what is called a vegan diet. Many people I know have no idea of my preferences, and I'm not fond of those who project moral superiority from this sort of eating. A lifelong student, as I was taught to be, I am a very conservative person. I'm a well-educated independent business owner. Jack's attitude is a result of being ill-informed about vegetarianism. Jack is a treasure for sure. Thank you. And he does a great job in dialogue with VDH, but I must ask him to reflect on this. By the way, I made some good profits investing in Beyond Meat and then selling fast after achieving substantial gains. Ed McGill. Ed, I'm sorry I mentioned that last thing because maybe one of the new 87,000 IRS agents.
You should listen to that.
Yeah. But I do want to say, okay, I appreciate your comments. I don't mock lifestyles. What I do think was how we got into Beyond Meat or vegan and vegetarianism, Victor's, is the one of the wars on the climate change fronts is a war on, as we know, on water, to deprive people of water. And that's to deprive people of food, even by restricting nitrogen-based fertilizers. And of course, there's a great effort to restrict ranchers and people who own cows and sheep and whatever. Oh, the animals fart, and that creates methane, and that's destroying. You know, they're part of the climate change problem. So there's a bit of a war on. On meat. God bless the vegetarians and the vegans. Go forth and eat.
I think that's a good point, God. One of my closest friends was John Heath. He was the co-author with me of Who Killed Homer. And when we wrote that book over 25 years ago, we got to talk each night about, and he's a vegetarian. And one of the things, and his is a moral issue. You didn't want to have animals killed. Right. But my point was, but the more I talked to him, the more rational he seems. It wasn't my choices, but you couldn't find a more level-headed, responsible, sober person than he. And then later, when my late daughter decided she was going to be a vegetarian, I was worried about, protein, B12, all that stuff. And I remember I had the same discussions with her, but it was always about her health. But she was like John. It was a different issue for them. They weren't anti-meat. They just didn't want to eat meat themselves. And I disagreed with that. By the way, I got my blood test for my long COVID, and one of the shocking things was my serum protein is low, globulin. So I'm wondering, how can that be other than COVID? Because I am a voracious meat eater. Mm. 3 or 4 times a week. So I'm going to, in reaction to that, eat more meat. And it was very funny because you would think that with COVID, everything would be messed up, but my cholesterol dived to 128 as I ate more meat and had a low protein serum count. I can't figure that out.
Well, I've had the pleasure and joy of eating at your house a few times, and Mrs. Hansen cooks a mighty mean steak. So I can see why you eat a lot of meat the way she cooks it. So, hey, Victor, okay. thanks for your wisdom. Thanks everyone who's listened to this podcast and all the podcasts. And we'll be back soon with another episode of the Victor Davis Hansen Show.
Thank you, everybody.